This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome. Welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
he says mining projects in the area are also hurting by increasing demand and competition for water.
That's Kudzai Zenawashi reporting. Details coming up also. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says his country remains united after a week of violent clashes. We'll have these stories and more ahead on Africa News Tonight. Our top story, Ethiopian Prime Minister breaks the silence with a written statement on clashes as the official death toll in the country rises to 67. VOA Salem Salomon has the story.
Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says his country remains united after a week of violent clashes left at least 67 people dead and several religious sites destroyed. Now, he is trying to restore calm. In a statement issued Saturday, Abiy said he was deeply saddened by the spate of attacks. This is a test that shows if Ethiopians don't work together in collaboration and in unison, that it could turn our road to be a difficult and a scary one, he wrote in Amharic. The clashes began Wednesday when a prominent activist from the Oromo ethnic group, Jawar Mohammed, publicly accused the government security forces of plotting an attack against him, a claim denied by local police. A chaotic wave of violence ensued. Protesters, some from rival groups, took to the streets. Arsonists set buildings ablaze. Security forces descended and struggled to restore calm. 62 protesters and 5 police officers were killed, Reuters reported. Most were stoned to death, with many of the fatalities occurring in the city of Adama and the surrounding Oromia region. Ethiopia is home to a diverse set of ethnicities and religious groups, and some of last week's violence appears to be based on ethnicity and religion. Houses of worship were burnt down. Businesses and residential homes have been destroyed. Displaced people are looking for shelter in different places, Abiy wrote. Deeds that are horrific to hear, let alone to see, have been committed against our citizens. In an interview with VOA, Jawar said he and other leaders have called for calm.
Almost all the opposition leaders, elders, clergymen and myself appeal for people to remain calm, to return home, to open roads and be patient. So people quickly responded by disbanding protesters, removing roadblocks and returning to their home, to their normal life. So normal business activity has resumed.
Jawar added that he believes people came from outside the region to cause mischief and attack protesters.
They are saying strangers from out of the town descended on towns and engaged in violence and in attacks, and also hooligans in inner cities seem to have been involved. But it's yet to be clear what happened.
In his statement, Abiy said he saw evidence the country can be united even in the aftermath of such a violent week. He rejected division based on religion or ethnicity, underscoring the country's capacity for unity. Even though we are saddened by this heartbreaking situation, we are able to see that Ethiopians are still great, observant, and reasonable people, he wrote. We have Muslims who protect churches from burning down, and Christians who stand on guard to prevent mosques from burning down. We have Ethiopian citizens who pay a price to protect someone who's outside of their ethnic group, Abiy said. But several ethnic groups continue to vie for recognition as independent, autonomous regions within the country. Other groups seek statehood altogether separate from Ethiopia, an ongoing concern for the government less than a year before voters head to the polls for the country's national election in May. Salem Solomon, VOA News, Washington.
A planned 600-kilometer march from Zimbabwe's capital to Hwenge National Park is aimed at shining a light on the plight of wildlife amid a major drought and raise resources to feed endangered animals. Organizers say they will advise a date for the march soon. Reporter Kuzazanwash has more details.
The government recently announced that 55 elephants had starved to death in Wange due to climate change-induced drought, and that other animals were at risk. Other factors are also contributing to the situation, as Zimbabwe National Park spokesperson Tinashe Farao explains.
The elephants are now overpopulated. The ecological carrying capacity of Wange National Park is 15,000. When it was created in the 1930s, it had about 2,000, but the maximum was supposed to be 15,000. We are now sitting on more than 50,000. That park is not expanding, but the population is ever growing.
Lenin Chisaira is the director of a pro-environment non-profit organization called Advocacy for Earth. He says mining projects in the area are also hurting by increasing demand and competition for water.
Wildlife, especially in Wange National Park, they are greatly affected by the expansion of the coal mining industries. There have been, in recent years, lots of coal claims being opened up for the coal mining business, and obviously when there is coal mining, mining is a destructive business in itself, and it has the effect of driving wildlife away, competing with wildlife for resources such as water, even destroying up, you know, grazing lands.
Chisaira says it's worrying that the death of 55 elephants was only made public recently.
That's a great puzzle. We are greatly concerned when these reports are coming out after there have been global and local outcry over the way we've been treating and trade wildlife. Because, you know, these statements came up in the same week that Zimbabwe was going to export over 35 young elephants to Asia. That's like a justification.
This comes after media reports that the elephants were shipped to Asia despite a pending legal case to stop their export. The Convention on International Trade of Endangered Species recently banned the exportation of elephants, a rule that will come into law on November 27th. For VOA, this is Kudzai Zvinalashe from Harare.
Rwanda is the latest African country to sign a nuclear deal with Russian state atomic company Rosatom, but the deals between Russia and several African countries are raising concerns with environmentalists who say nuclear energy is not always clean and does not come free. Mohamed Yusuf reports.
A Russia-Africa summit in Sochi. Russia this week brought together the head of state and government representatives from 55 countries. Speaking at the forum, Russian President Vladimir Putin said his government is offering African countries an opportunity to use nuclear technology. Rosatom is prepared to help our African partners in creating a nuclear industry on a turnkey basis. The construction of research centers based on multifunctional reactors, Putin says. Rosatom is building a $29 billion nuclear plant for Egypt. The same company is helping Uganda, the Republic of Congo, and Rwanda to establish nuclear facilities. Right now, South Africa is the only country in the continent with nuclear power plant. In Rwanda, Rosatom will construct the Center of Nuclear Science and Technologies. In Nigeria, a planned Rosatom nuclear reactor may provide the West African nation with electricity. Environmental activists are aware of these deals. Jack Paul Philip works with Nigeria's Environment Rights Action.
We continue to hear, for instance, that nuclear energy is clean. But in truth, it is not clean because you would need a lot of water to keep the nuclear plant clean. Cool. You need an independent power plant to keep on powering it 24/7. Now, if you need that much power to keep that plant running, then it shows it is not clean.
Most African countries have needs that could be met by nuclear energy. According to the International Energy Agency, 57% of Africa's population does not have easy access to electricity, and those who have it must deal with frequent power outages. Michael Gatari is the head of nuclear science and technology at the University of Nairobi. He says African countries can pursue nuclear technology, but must get their own people to manage the nuclear reactors.
We should have in-country, competent, well-trained manpower, not depending on expatriate support. because that will be very expensive in the long run. It will make even the power more expensive. So human manpower development for nuclear energy is very critical.
Qatari also says Russia is seeking business in Africa, not giving away gifts.
Africa is not going to get a free reactor. They are selling their technology. So the issue of helping does not come in. Of course, there is a component, we will train your people, we'll do this, but still, if you calculate the cost, it is we who are covered. So the African countries should move into it with a business vision.
And in Sochi, where Putin rolled out the red carpet for African leaders, he reminded them Russia was open for business. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
Sudan once had the largest railway network in Africa, with most of the train cars obtained from the United States. But decades of negligence, economic troubles, and U.S. sanctions have made the railway reliant on Chinese-made trains and parts that it can hardly afford. With the recent ouster of Omar al-Bashir, the railway's supporters are hoping the United States will soon lift sanctions to help restore its former glory. Naba Mahadin reports from Khartoum.
65-year-old Mahdi Yassin has been working for the Sudan Railways Corporation since 1972. Yassin remembers the railway's glory days when it was the largest in Africa, running 5,000 kilometers, 3,100 miles from the Egyptian Red Sea and crisscrossing Sudan to what is now South Sudan. Yassin says Jebet School was graduating 100 students per year, all qualified to work on the railway. It was a strong corporation. There was abundance in spare parts and locomotives. But the railway fell apart through mismanagement and a fear of organized labor's influence on the economy and politics. Now, railway workshops in Sudan look like a graveyard, littered with dozens of vehicles, some of them idle for decades. Sudan fired thousands of qualified rail workers, replacing some with political appointees put in place after former President Omar al-Bashir came to power. Railway workers hope Bashir's ouster in April will encourage the United States to lift sanctions it imposed on Sudan for human rights abuses and harboring terrorists. Mahmoud Saleh is the director of engineers in Khartoum Train Workshop. Saleh says if the sanctions are lifted, they can at least be updated with the technology of the trains. Saleh adds that Sudan is so late to update the current technology. It's functioning with the past century's technology. They need to update and then develop. After the British colonial era, the state-run railway became reliant on U.S. trains and replacement parts. But because of sanctions, Khartoum has been unable to buy U.S. parts, leaving only 18 of the railway's 106 U.S.-made trains in service. Sudan Railways Corporation Director Muhammad Hamid said the railway turned to China to keep the trains running. Hamid says when the U.S. embargo cut out everything, they had to import their spare parts and needs from other countries. He adds that they restored to China. They have the American locomotives. And of course, China can't produce the American spare parts, especially the main machines from Caterpillar Inc. So what they were going to do? Importing a few Chinese trains in 2014 allowed Sudan to launch two new passenger lines, but poor track conditions means the trains can only go 60 kilometers per hour, half their maximum speed. Before Yassin retires at the end of this year, he hopes to see U.S. sanctions lifted and more efforts by Sudan's transitional government to get the country's railways back on track. Naba Muhiddin for VOA News, Khartoum.
You're listening to Africa News Tonight live on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz on the Voice of America. I'm Yehiyus Wuhib in Washington. 19 past the hour, here's a recap of our top stories. Ethiopian Prime Minister Abiy Ahmed says his country remains united after a week of violent clashes. And Rwanda signs a nuclear deal with a Russian state atomic company, which is raising concern. And for more news and information, visit our website at voaafrica.com. The Rwandan government has started reintegrating 380 students into schools after their studies in the Democratic Republic of Congo were halted due to concerns over the Ebola virus. But parents are claiming they can't find education in Rwanda that is as good as in the DRC. They're urging the government to improve instruction. Eugene Uwimana has more details from Kigali, Rwanda.
After nearly 2 months back at home, the students are going to inter-Rwandan schools. They say they were very disappointed when they were told in August they couldn't travel to the DRC anymore due to the Ebola outbreak there. She says, they have called me to go to school and submit our group assignment. I'm the one who has to present it. Now they can give us zero. I don't understand how they are locking me in the country, saying I'm not allowed to cross. I was going to learn skills to use here in the country. The Rwandan government says it understands their problem. Irene Yambaje, the director of Rwanda Education Board, says the students who have been taught in French are going to get short course in English and Kinyarwanda so they can study with others. He says they are going to accompany them in this reintegration journey. After the short course, we give them schools. Those schools, we have to know that though the students have been trained, courses need to be enhanced. We are not going to build their schools. We are putting them in ordinary ones, but with a special treatment. Their parents doubt the quality of education in Rwanda. They urge the government to improve. He says, we took our children in DRC not because schools are cheap there. Here in Rwanda, after 3 years in a school, my child could not write his name. I then angrily took him in DRC. He performed well. He was in a senior too, but he says very good French. Leaders, please help us improve the quality of education. We have money. We can pay whichever price. We need a real education. The Ministry of Education has counted the 380 Rwandan students whose education has been affected by Ebola. The World Health Organization says the outbreak in the DRC has claimed more than 2,000 lives since it was declared 15 months ago. Eugene Uwimana for VOA News, Kigali, Rwanda.
Authorities in Cameroon have deployed soldiers and rescue workers after a torrential downpour caused a landslide that killed at least 34 people overnight near the western town of Bafoussam. Rescue workers spent Tuesday searching through the wreckage of destroyed homes. Moki Edwin Kenzeka reports from Bafoussam.
Heavy rains Tuesday in the neighborhood called Kadifun Guche have not stopped rescue workers from digging through mounds of mud and debris. The workers are hoping to find more survivors, but are mostly searching for bodies trapped in the landslide that occurred late on Monday night. Augustin Awafonka, governor of the region, said he has called in 4 bulldozers to help clear away the crumbled houses.
There are several corpses that are buried in here. The rescue operations are still ongoing, so at the end of it, they will be able to identify the number of persons that are actually dead. But of course, it is clear that we'll have to ask the people who are resident in this area to leave the area, because the area is actually very dangerous.
34 corpses have been pulled from the rubble so far and taken to the mortuary of the regional hospital in Bafoussam. More than 30 people are still missing. At least 70 people sustained injuries in the landslide. Some were taken to hospitals, where 6 are in critical conditions. About 20 houses were completely destroyed. 61-year-old Zonkewe Tanyi says he is still in search of 3 of his children and uncle. He says it was very difficult for them who were in relatively safer areas to assist those who were crying help, because the incident occurred at about 10 p.m. on Monday night when places were dark and they did not have electricity. He says his prayer is to find his relatives alive. K Cameroon Minister of Decentralization, George Elanga Obam, visited the site and handed over a $50,000 donation from the government. He said the money is helped to those who have lost all of their belongings and are hungry without food and water. Obam suggested that survivors rebuild their houses elsewhere.
A certain number of familles étaient installées ici, des adultes et des enfants.
He says it is rather unfortunate that so many families decided to risk their lives by settling on the zone which is prone to flooding and landslides. He says the cause of the incident is the rains that have been pouring ceaselessly over the past 2 weeks. Less than 2 weeks ago, heavy rains and floods also left at least 100,000 people homeless on both sides of the border between northern Cameroon and Chad. Moki Edwin Kinzeka for VOA News, Bafoussam, Western Cameroon.
Nigeria's Paralympic athletes have outshined their able-bodied counterparts in world competitions year after year. Yet, these athletes face such challenges as lack of proper training facilities and inadequate funding. But a new administration recently took over managing the sports industry and is promising better treatment of Nigeria's Paralympic athletes. More from Timothy Obiezu in Abuja.
Abdulaziz Ibrahim, who's known as Nigeria's para powerlifting champion, is training hard for the powerlifting competition of the Paralympic Games next year in Japan. In 2016, he was part of the disabled team that won medals for Nigeria at the Rio Paralympic Games. Despite dominating world championships, Abdulaziz says the performances of Nigeria's Paralympic athletes are a result of their personal sacrifices and fighting spirits.
So I'm a champion, but when you see me along the road, I'm not looking like a champion. But if you go to abroad, you see the champion, see they are disabled. If you see their life, see their cars, it's different. But every day we always make Nigeria proud. I don't make us proud. Why?
Nigerian Paralympians complain they get less funding than their able-bodied counterparts who win fewer medals and are treated like second-class athletes. Queen Ubo is the president of Nigeria's Para Powerlifting Federation.
If they can give 10% of the attention they give to soccer, as they call it, football over here, to para powerlifting or parasport, I think the sky will be our beginning.
Nigerians Paralympians lack proper training facilities too. At an under-equipped facility in Abuja, para-athletes like Abdulaziz say they are making do training for the Olympic Games with what's available. But a new sports minister, Sunday Akindari, who took over the sports ministry a few months back, is promising to address very issues.
I think what you do for this country, in spite of the circumstances, is very commendable. We invest so much in the able-bodied sportsmen and women. I think we should invest equally in the Paralympics.
Nigeria's Paralympic team won all 4 gold medals in the powerlifting category at the Commonwealth Games, followed by Malaysia and India. While Abdulaziz and his fellow athletes don't have much to show for their wins, they are hanging on a hope that things will get better. Timothy Obiezu for VOA News, Abuja.
And that wraps up this edition of African News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. For listeners on VOA's Nairobi FM station, please stay tuned for the Swahili Evening News coming up at 16:30 UTC. For all other listeners, please stay tuned to the sunny side of sports. And thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.